From Bogota, Colombia, this is Free Speech Radio News. Over the next half hour, Obama's pick to head U.S. forces in Afghanistan reveals his military past. El Salvador inaugurates a new president. And this year marks the 15th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. We go to Kigali and talk to a survivor. I'm Manuel Rueda. Stay tuned for all this and more. But first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown's government appears to be in crisis as his Home Secretary resigns and other cabinet ministers and Labour MPs are stepping down. From London, Naomi Fowler.
For the last few weeks, British parliamentarians have been engulfed in the biggest scandal for decades over allegations regarding abuse of their expenses. Many MPs have tried for years to keep the details out of the public domain, but the specifics were finally sold to a newspaper, which has been publishing new allegations on a daily basis. While some MPs claimed for mortgages that didn't exist, others claimed public money for things including hanging chandeliers, clearing out moats, and even buying an ornamental duck house. The Home Secretary is resigning from the Cabinet after revelations about her expenses. The Children's Minister will also not stand again as an MP. Now, the Chancellor may also be forced out of the Cabinet over his expense claims. By the end of this political crisis, as many as a third of Britain's members of Parliament from all parties may step down. Criminal charges may well follow. With the European and local elections on Thursday, all the main parties are expected to experience the worst election results in their history. Small parties, such as the Greens and Nationalist parties, are expected to do well. Many now believe with a general election only a year away, a challenge for Gordon Brown's leadership may be imminent. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Hundreds of people who were abducted yesterday in Pakistan while traveling in a convoy of minibuses are free today. The caravan included students from a military-run university, teachers, and members of their families. Earlier, some 200 of them escaped on their own. Soldiers then confronted the Taliban as they moved the remaining 71 students and 9 staff along a roadway bound for South Waziristan. While the militants escaped, all those still held were rescued. A Texas death row inmate is scheduled to die this evening in the U.S. state most likely to kill. Rachel Clark has more.
At 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, Terry Lee Hankins will be the 200th person executed in Huntsville, Texas, on Governor Rick Perry's watch. Hankins was convicted of 3 counts of murder in the 2001 deaths of his estranged wife and 2 stepchildren. Since taking office in December 2000, Governor Perry has authorized more executions than any other governor in United States history. Texas has the highest rate of executions in the United States and 3rd highest in the world, behind Saudi Arabia and China. Altogether, Texas has executed 437 people since 1982, including 152 under former Texas governor and 2-term president George W. Bush. Death penalty abolition groups are encouraging individuals to flood Perry's office with faxes, emails, and phone calls. A coordinated series of vigils and protests are also scheduled to take place across the state. Reporting from Houston, Texas, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
China shut down Twitter, Hotmail, and the Huffington Post, along with other internet networking sites today, in advance of Thursday's anniversary of the massacre at Tiananmen Square. And Human Rights Watch said today that former political prisoner Wu Gaojing was arrested shortly after the publication of a letter he co-signed describing alleged economic discrimination against dissidents. 2 weeks after the Sri Lankan government declared victory over the Tamil Tiger rebels, some say repression simmers. A rights group said today it received a threat, and yesterday a prominent journalist was attacked. Free Speech Radio News' Ponia Manikavasagam.
After the declaration of victory, analysts say government supporters are angry and are directing their ire at journalists and peace activists who they say supported the rebels during the war. On Monday, Podala Jayanta, an award-winning journalist and activist, was abducted near his house, badly assaulted and later dumped in the suburb of Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo. He is recovering in hospital today. Dr. Jehan Pereira is the director of the National Peace Council.
Now, we don't know who has done this, but I think it is the duty of the government to ensure that journalists and NGOs have freedom to function within the framework of the law and express their views freely and do their work.
Pro-government supporters are actively trying to link those who have been critical of the government and its policies with the LTT rebels. The Center for Policy Alternatives, or the CPA, is an NGO engaged in good governance and advocacy for peace. The center's director says they received a threatening letter today accusing them of treason. Media groups, journalists, and opposition party politicians condemned the attack on the journalist and urged the government to take immediate action to bring the culprits to justice. Ponnaiya Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
In Washington, D.C., the Senate Armed Services Committee held a hearing for Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, President Obama's pick to head U.S. forces in Afghanistan. McChrystal testified about his military past, saying he knew of torture tactics at Abu Ghraib. He also warned of more Afghan civilian casualties. FSRN's Karen Miller reports.
General McChrystal served as commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. This command was in charge of the Abu Ghraib prison. Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin questioned him on if the policy on detainee abuse happened.
Stress positions, use of dogs, and nudity. Is that correct?
Sir, it did. We did not use all of the things that were outlined there.
Some of them were used?
Some of them were used when I took over, sir, and then as we immediately began to reduce that.
You immediately began what?
To reduce those, sir. Okay.
McChrystal said he thought the techniques were legal, but he told Senator Levin that he worked to improve them. Senator Levin seemed skeptical.
When you say you improved them, you reduced the number of techniques which were utilized, even though they had been authorized.
That's
Is that correct?
Correct? That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Now, were you uncomfortable with some of the techniques that you saw there?
When I took over, I was, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And the direction of reduction of the use of those techniques, even though they had been authorized by the Secretary, nonetheless was something that you felt was appropriate and necessary.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
McChrystal was nominated to lead the forces in Afghanistan after Secretary of Defense Robert Gates fired General David McKiernan after only a year on the job. Gates said the new military leader was needed to move ahead with the new U.S. strategy. So far, some estimates show that there have been over 27,000 civilian deaths in Afghanistan. McChrystal acknowledges that civilian deaths will happen, but he promises to work to decrease them.
My intent, if confirmed, is to review all of our existing rules of engagement, review all of our tactical directives, get with all of our forces with the goal of not putting ourselves in a position, except when we have to protect American or coalition or Afghan forces, actual survival, from positions where we create civilian casualties.
Lawmakers also questioned him about his involvement with the Pat Tillman case. Former professional football player and Army Ranger Tillman was killed by fellow U.S. soldiers, but for years the Army denied it. Some charged a cover-up, but McChrystal said he signed a citation recognizing Tillman without knowing all the facts.
What we have learned since is it is better to take your time, make sure you get everything right with the award and not rush it.
Robert Naiman is senior policy analyst at Just Foreign Policy. He says McChrystal's background in special operations will lead to a more covert war.
In Pakistan, we have the drone strikes, which are essentially, you know, kind of assassination. There are already special operations, very controversial special operations activities in Afghanistan with night raids, and things constantly leading to civilian casualties. So at a time when people in the peace movement have been trying to get Congress to exercise more oversight, McChrystal's appointment seems to signal in the opposite direction.
but Crystal will likely be confirmed by the full Senate in upcoming weeks. Meanwhile, President Obama announced a new person to head the U.S. Army, a Republican, John McHugh. McHugh has been a member of the House Armed Services Committee for 16 years. He will be the second known Republican appointed to a civilian military post. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Nominee to be Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor spent the day on Capitol Hill. She met with both Democratic and Republican senators crucial to her confirmation. Democrats praised her credentials and demeanor, and while Republicans distanced themselves from incendiary remarks made by conservatives, they withheld judgment. Assistant Republican leader John Kyle is also a member of the Judiciary Committee. He says he wants to know if Judge Sotomayor agrees with President Obama's criteria for a judge.
And he said that in 95% of the cases, judges agree, but that last 5%, there may not be precedent, there may not be law that dictates the result, and that's when you have to let your feelings, your preconceived notions, your sense of empathy, and other factors enter in, including whether you want to help the little guy. That's wrong.
Republicans say they will thoroughly examine her record. The Central American country of El Salvador inaugurated a new president Monday. Former journalist Mauricio Funes became El Salvador's first left-wing president in decades. Before seeking power at the ballot box, Funes's party, the FMLN, fought a bloody civil war against government forces in the 1980s. For some Salvadorians, this election marks a turning point in their country's history. Carla Aguilar reports from La Libertad.
The 1992 Chapultepec Peace Accords ended 12 years of bloody civil war between the FMLN, an umbrella group of left-wing guerrillas, and the Salvadoran government. June 1st, the FMLN assumed control of the executive as 20-year veteran journalist and correspondent for CNN, Carlos Mauricio Funes Cartagena, was sworn in 87th president of the Republic of El Salvador. Former FMLN military leader, Comandante Chano Guevara.
For the first time, the Salvadoran left will take the presidency of the Republic of El Salvador. This is an important victory for all those who struggled during the Civil War, and I would even say including before the war for independence in 1821.
The FMLN's candidates, Salvador Sánchez Serén and Mauricio Funes, won the vice presidency and presidency respectively with 51% of the vote, campaigning for hope to overcome fear. ARENA, the Alliance of Republican Nationalists, governed for the previous 20 years and held close ties to the United States. Salvadoran domestic policy, such as the 2001 inflation-provoking dollarization and the enactment of the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, are examples of decades of deep U.S. influence in the country. Roberto Cañas is former official spokesperson for the FMLN and co-signer of the peace accords. He spoke about the future of U.S.-El Salvador relations.
The fundamental aspect is that it not interfere with the internal affairs of these countries. The level of involvement of the United States in the Reagan era was very high. For that administration, the line of Soviet-Cuban expansion during the Cold War was between Nicaragua and El Salvador. So much of their foreign policy was directed at trying to influence us. For example, in El Salvador, it spent $1 million a day to finance the internal war in our country.
For many, Funes' election provokes hope in a time of crisis. It currently ranks 61st among 135 developing nations, according to the 2008-2009 United Nations Human Development Index. Luis Ramirez Menéndez is the director of the School for Human Rights of the Ombudsman's Office.
What most concerns Salvadorians is the high level of poverty in this country, and that the public policies that have been implemented by the right-wing governments of the last 20 years have been insufficient to have a dignified life in Salvadorian society, because that's what it's about, minimum standards of living. A dignified life that allows a person to at least have a dignified job and develop like any other run-of-the-mill person can.
During Funes' speech, a four-part global anti-crisis plan worth $475 million was unveiled, backing up a campaign promise of having a preferential option for the poor. The plan includes microfinancing for small and medium-sized businesses, a state banking system, universal protections for marginalized sectors of society, and state spending for infrastructure development. Regarding his mandate, Funes declares,
"We are not just a country that is to be helped or favored. We are, as of today, from this instant, before the eyes of our own people and those abroad, a leadership and a people who struggled for an opportunity, which finally had it, and once achieving it, did not waste it, did not frustrate it, and knew how to carry it to its greatest potential."
Alfredo Cristiani, former president of El Salvador and Arena's executive committee chair, denounced Funes' acceptance speech, indicating that it was empty and with unjustified accusations. Further, that the meritocracy Funes referred to was not present in his cabinet selections. Mauricio Funes will govern El Salvador until 2014 without chance for re-election. Carla Aguilar, FSRN La Libertad.
And now to the Middle East. A 15-member UN fact-finding mission is in Gaza to investigate human rights violations during the January Israeli attacks on the region. The mission's arrival comes a few days after Amnesty International's annual report highlighted a series of Israeli violations early this year. The Amnesty report also suggests that the ruling Hamas party has committed human rights violations throughout the Gaza Strip. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari sends us this report.
The Amnesty report looked at nine categories of human rights in Gaza and the West Bank, including arbitrary arrests and detentions, the justice system, torture, excessive use of force, and a freedom of expression. In Gaza, Amnesty says there were widespread reports that people detained by Hamas were beaten and tortured. Some were killed. Majid al-Dabbaki says his 48-year-old brother, Nihad Saadi, was one of those arrested, tortured, lynched, and then found dead on the roadside last February. Majid al-Dabbaki says Hamas security forces accused his brother of collaborating with Israel.
The government is still playing a game with this. If it were a competent government, it has to face the family with a legal document proving my brother was guilty. Suppose my brother was guilty. At least we need proof from this government so we can come to terms with the faults my brother committed. We don't want only to come to terms with people, but also with God, so my brother can lay in rest. We never accept the way my brother was killed. Never.
However, al-Dabbaki says they have been repeatedly asking the Hamas government to provide them with an indictment against Nihad, yet they haven't received any response. The Hamas-led government in Gaza says that those accused of collaborating with Israel provided Israel with information about Gaza fighters during the January war on the region. Dr. Ahmad Youssef is a spokesperson for the Hamas government in Gaza.
The Ministry of Interior investigating these cases, and since we are preparing for the fact-finding mission to investigate what happened here in Gaza during the war, I think the government is preparing a report also to explain what really happened during the time of war and who are responsible for if any of these cases been if any of those family saw anybody in the court. I am sure by that time we will have answer to these kind of questions.
Yet, according to Amnesty International, Hamas's actions were extrajudicial. Amnesty's report also found that Hamas is detaining hundreds of other Gazan men, including members of the rival Fatah party and suspected collaborators. So far, none have had a trial. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
This Thursday, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda will be presenting progress of the genocide trials to the United Nations in New York. As the court continues to try to hold people accountable for the genocide, survivors are marking the 15th anniversary of the genocide, a dark period for the world in which many Western countries failed to stop a 100-day massacre. during which 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were slaughtered in an attempt to eliminate Tutsis from the tiny East African country. FSRN's Tanya Castle sat down with Freddy Mutangwa, a genocide survivor who now runs the Gizosi Genocide Museum in Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
You are a genocide survivor. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, my experience actually as a survivor, I lost my family and my parents and my four sisters, and I remain with one sister who is living in Kigali now. Right after genocide, you find you are alone. It's very, very sad. From my experience, actually, I was alone and have to take care of my young sister. We didn't have a house, we didn't have any money, we didn't have any job. So we decided to come to Kigali.
How did you survive during the genocide?
I remember on the 13th, I shared the last food with my mother because the following day, they attacked my home and she has been killed. My family died on the 14th, and that time I found my sister in the street. So we left Kibuye, the west of country, went to south of country, Gikongoro. It took me about 3 months to get there. Another man, who is very good man, who lent me his ID card. This false identity card was helped me a lot to cross the roadblocks from Kibuye to Gikongoro. And from Gikongoro, it was about July, where I decided to come to Kigali. So we lived in Kigali, and we started actually to think how we can survive, how we can bring back our new life.
How important is it for you as a survivor to connect with other survivors?
It was very important to be together, as people we share the same story. Because you have at least someone you can tell your pain, and he can tell his pain or her pain to you. And it's an experience I got from school as well, where we formed an association and we formed small families. You shared everything, education materials, your pain, your emotion, and everything were shared inside the association.
Talking about sharing stories and sharing the story of the genocide, you are the director of the Gisozi National Memorial Site, which is also a museum.
Yeah.
How important is it to you that this museum exists?
This memorial has very important objective and significant for Rwandans, for the world as human being. People in the world do not understand the connection they have as human being, as humanity. During genocide in this country, the international community didn't care about what was happening here. The reason why you have other genocide, it showed the connection. And not only Rwandans who suffered from genocide, but other people have suffered from genocide. And it's also a call for human being to share, to work hand in hand to prevent genocide. We need to work for prevention together.
This year marks the 15th anniversary of the 1994 genocide against Tutsis. The message is hope that the Commission to Fight Genocide has put out. Do you think that is an appropriate message?
Absolutely. 15 years after genocide, we need to look back how we managed to survive. We need to evaluate ourselves, but we need to think for the future. So it's time to talk about hope. But the hope have to be alongside with action. When we say hope, there is a hope of rebuilding our hearts, rebuilding our emotion, rebuilding our nation, and everything.
You are recently married. What will you tell your children one day about the genocide and about what happened to you?
I'm very, very against of people who keep quiet in front of their children. Of course, you don't have to traumatize them. You have to find a good way, but my children will know me, and they will know country, they will know the history of country, but in the very positive way. I say this happened. It's like a warning for them that I will give the future of this country in their hand. I do my part. They have to do their part also to make sure this country do not suffer again of what we have suffered.
That was reporter Tanya Castle speaking with Rwandan genocide survivor Freddie Mutangwa. You can download our newscasts at www.fsrn.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. The contested Senate race between Republican Norm Coleman and Democrat Al Franken took another step in its long journey toward resolution when it reached the Minnesota Supreme Court on Monday. The contest and subsequent court cases have now entered their seventh month. On Monday, the High Court heard arguments by attorneys from both sides and will likely spend the next several weeks reaching its decision. But even after the Minnesota court makes its ruling, the case could still be appealed to federal court. Marty Owings brings us a story from St. Paul.
Franken's attorney Mark Elias argued that the lower court had ruled correctly in its treatment of absentee ballots, and that it clearly showed Franken had more legally cast votes than did Coleman. Joel Friedberg, arguing on behalf of Norm Coleman, said that the lower court had erred when it failed to provide equal protection under the law, meaning that ballots cast in different counties and precincts were treated differently. He argued that this disparity caused voter disenfranchisement. Senator Norm Coleman said afterwards that he believed the issues of ballots that were not counted equally makes it difficult to declare a winner.
It's very difficult to say you have that consent when you have a race that's separated by a few hundred votes and there are thousands more that have not been counted. I firmly believe that Minnesotans understand the importance of getting it right. We're very close to that point right now, and I'm hopeful that will happen.
Coleman attorney Joel Friedberg explained it this way.
It's really strange that the counties with the resources, like Minneapolis, Ramsey County, and St. Louis County, the Democratic strongholds, are the ones that relaxed the standards and let the higher percentage of ballots in, while those good old conservative Republican counties followed the rules. We pay for that now.
Friedberg summarized what their side is asking from the Minnesota Supreme Court in the case.
What we've asked them to do is to send it back to the three-judge panel, apply the same standards as election night, reevaluate the unopened ballots, let the ones in that should go in.
Friedberg was asked if the plan all along would be to appeal the case to the federal courts.
Never, while you have a case pending in front of one court, indicate whether or not you're going to appeal. That's a type of attempted intimidation that I don't indulge in and nobody should.
Al Franken's attorney Mark Elias said that he believed the process would end with a Minnesota Supreme Court ruling.
I do think it's fair to say that, you know, with a ruling from the state Supreme Court, we will be at the end of this process. You know, Minnesota law provides for an automatic recount. We went through that. Al Franken came out the winner of that process by 225 votes. It then provides for a second step, which is a state election contest. We went through 7 weeks of that trial, and Al Franken's lead expanded to 312 votes. And that's the final margin of victory in this. And we look forward to the Supreme Court's final decision, and that should bring us to the end of the state court process, and hopefully the end of the need for press conferences like this.
A final ruling is expected within the next few weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Marty Owings at the Minnesota Supreme Court.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Jose, headlines editor Nell Abram, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Buck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.